Well, thank you very much for this opportunity and invitation, in particular to David. I'm afraid I'm going to argue against the implicit title, well, the title and the implicit argument in my own paper. And that's because I've changed my mind since David asked me. And I hope you forgive that. And so let me start by dispensing with two misconceptions and making one claim. The first misconception is that apartheid was brought down by external diplomatic, military, or economic pressure, such as trade boycotts and disinvestment. All played a role, but the major reason for change was internal. The second misconception is perhaps the hair that I set running myself, and that is about human rights. Now, certainly, the idea that the awareness of human rights was a leading or principal factor in raising public awareness of the evils of apartheid and in guiding the boycott movement, all this had a role. But as I'm going to say in a moment, I think it is easy to oversimplify it and indeed to exaggerate the idea of rights consciousness. My claim is that the anti-apartheid boycott was in many ways sui generis. I guess that's easy. Historians always make that claim. To the extent that the anti-apartheid boycott was a success, this had much to do with what I like to think of as the intimate ties of association between South Africa and Britain in particular, an associational network that developed as a result of a very long colonial history and an equally long set of post-colonial linkages, which together stretched over the better part of two centuries. Now, human rights, I think, was not essential to the apartheid movement, but it was certainly convenient. It was part of an assemblage of ideas and claims of which national self-determination, and I'm grateful for the both the two prior keynote speakers, because I'm arguing in many ways in sympathy with them. National self-determination, anti-colonialism, anti-capitalism seem to me to be more important than human rights. Certainly, human rights featured episodically as a campaigning slogan in the anti-apartheid movement, perhaps more so in New York than in London, where proximity to the United Nations was a key factor. For activists who considered that apartheid was more a political and a social problem than a matter of moral conscience, rights were an inadequate and in some ways actually the wrong instrument with which to attack apartheid. Now, this raises a related point, namely whether we see boycott movements principally as a form of moral crusade or else as part of a broader political and economic strategy in pursuit of revolutionary social transformation. Now, clearly there are overlaps between two of these, the moral and the political strategic. But if one takes the perhaps well-known example of the boycott in Britain of South African goods, we can understand that many consumers in Britain avoided purchasing South African goods and registered their distaste for South African products. But this was not identical to the political calculations and the organizers of the boycotts, many of whom began to think increasingly that apartheid could only be brought down by a combination of military struggle and efforts to undermine the capitalist basis of the apartheid system. There's no time in this very short presentation to say anything about the long history of the boycott idea, but I am interested, and I think that it's not fully appreciated, that in fact this goes back very far in the mid-19th century Cape, at least, and specifically to 1848-1849, when there was a major campaign in Cape Town, the anti-convict campaign, which saw respectable colonial, the representatives of the respectable aspirant colonial middle classes, English and Dutch, joined together in protest against attempts to land convicts at the Cape. There are many ironies in the boycott movement, and one of the paradoxes of this was that on the ship Neptune, which was lying in Table Bay unable to enter the Cape because it was full of convicts was one John Mitchell, who happened to have been a leading light in the anti-colonial Irish resistance, who was sitting in Table Bay rather bemused about the boycott against him, as it were, something which he had been part of in Ireland. In 1853, very much part of this 1840, one of the sort of aftermath of the 1853 anti-convict agitation, the first election in the Cape, the first non-racial election, as it happens, was boycotted by many people in the name of Hottentot nationalism. So throughout South African history, boycott and non-cooperation of one sort or another form a very important part of local resistance to segregation and apartheid. And this is particularly so in the case of the coloured and Indian communities. And indeed, there are direct links here to the later sporting boycotts organized by activists like Dennis Brutus and Sam Ramsamy. No one, to my knowledge, has followed these links, and I think it would be very interesting if somebody would want to pick them up. Let me then skip forward another century to the modern boycott movement, which began as a reaction to the victory of the apartheid government in the electoral victory of the apartheid government in 1848. Now, in Britain, where the boycott movement first coalesced, we see the emergence of a finely imbricated network of campaigning organizations and interest groups that included the churches, trades unions, student organizations, and were brought together both by South African exiles, by immigrants, and many influential people in British public life. Now, some of these links and networks were transnational, but others were remarkably local and parochial and very much took on the idiom of politics, institutional politics, and pressure group activities within Britain itself. London was, of course, the natural center for anti-colonial campaigns in a post-colonial world, largely because it was the ex-imperial center. The anti-apartheid movement that developed through the 1950s represented a remarkable coalition, in many cases a fragile coalition, of groups and individuals that crossed class and political boundaries, though importantly, I think, without ever transcending these. August members of the Anglican Church, Rob Skinner has written very interestingly about the church and the anti-apartheid movement. Leading politicians in the Labour and Liberal parties played prominent roles, and there were a smattering of Tories as well. Grassroots mobilization depended on activists in the Communist Party, Communist parties, I should say, in trade unions, in the defense and aid solidarity organization that grew up around the treason trial from 1956, in student unions, and within pressure groups like the Africa Bureau. But a notable absence here was the Black British constituency, which was often rather skeptical, if not hostile, to the role of, in particular, white South African immigrants or exiles. To some extent, the methods of the boycott committee in London drew on long-established South African traditions of non-compliance, going back, of course, to Gandhi in particular, but these always were tailored to suit British circumstances, and indeed they couldn't take root had they not been adapted to local British circumstances. The boycott movement in Britain transmuted into the anti-apartheid movement around 1959, just before Sharpeville and indeed just after Sharpeville, the massacre in 1960, which gave such a powerful impetus to anti-apartheid movements internationally. I would argue that this shift from boycott to anti-apartheid, that's to say the birth of the anti-apartheid movement described in those terms, was a crucial change, because of the way in which the phrase anti-apartheid crystallized opposition to a system of racial repression in ways that, say, anti-Zionism has never or has not yet been able to do. At the rhetorical level, it was very easy to equate apartheid with racism because that is what it was and that is what it sounded like with its Germanic overtones. In the case of Israel, the logically prior step of defining Zionism as racism has proved rather less persuasive, so far at least. In the early 1960s, declarations were passed by playwrights in England and in Ireland that their work should not be performed before segregated audiences in South Africa. In 1965, the British Actors' Union Equity invited individual actors to pledge not to work in South Africa, and they were preceded by the Musicians' Union. The American Committee on Africa persuaded 60 cultural figures to say no to apartheid. But the interesting thing about the cultural boycott was that it was always asymmetrical. That is to say, it was designed to prevent overseas artists from performing in South Africa, but it did not stop liberal and left-wing South African theatre performances in London, New York, and elsewhere. Indeed, I would argue that international awareness of the horrors of apartheid, in particular its emotional and its personal complexities, were enormously stimulated by books and plays that performed in London and New York, and particularly at a time when the exile movement was at a really low stage of political activism. Sporting boycotts in South Africa began from the early 1960s. South Africa was excluded from the 1964 Tokyo Olympics, and it was then expelled from the Olympic movement itself in 1970, the first country to experience this indignity, and I think perhaps the only country ever to have been excluded from the Olympic movement. But somebody will tell me that I'm wrong. The real hurt, however, to South African national pride came with the Stop the Tour campaigns of 1969 and 1970, which targeted international cricket and rugby tests to this country and other parts of the ex-Commonwealth. This was a body blow to white South African masculine pride. And with all due respect to Israeli football, I'm not sure that anything can compare to the iconic place of rugby and cricket in the public imagination of South Africa, New Zealand, and Australia. So I think that's not one to follow. Now, what about the economic boycott? We should remember just how important, I think it's easy to forget, rather, just how important Britain was to South Africa, and indeed South Africa was to Britain, in the period of about up to the 1970s. In 1960, Sharpeville, Britain was by some distance South Africa's most important trading partner. It was also the largest source of foreign investment into the country, and it generated the investments in South Africa generated the highest returns, along with Malaysia, of returns of foreign investment anywhere else in the world, around 15 to 20% per annum around 1970. After Sharpeville, after 1960, far from overseas investment after a small blip leaving South Africa, the opposite happened. As the South African economy recovered and grew at an annual rate of more than 5%, American trade grew by 79%, British trade by 88%, and Japanese trade by nearly 400%. In the conditions of the Cold War, strategic and military connections remained very strong. And of course, South Africa remained a vital source of gold, of uranium, and of other strategic minerals too. Within the British political and economic establishment, there remained a very strong and active support for continuing engagement in South Africa. Politicians from Harold Macmillan to Margaret Thatcher fully understood the importance of these connections, as did Wilson and Callaghan. These connections involved traditional ties of kith and kin, and they were cemented by long and powerful connections in the worlds of industry, trade, and politics, and of course, journalism too. The debate about boycotting South Africa in Britain was always, therefore, a debate about what Britain was and how Britain was coming to terms with its own colonial history. Economic sanctions and boycotts also became central in academic analysis and political analysis, which began to show, particularly from the 1970s, that apartheid was at root a form of racial capitalism. That is to say, apartheid was not simply seen as a moral aberration, but rather it was seen as a highly sophisticated system of exploitation. The fact that British, German, and American firms profited so strongly and so visibly, mining houses in particular, from the South African connection, as it was called in an important book of that title, was proof for many that the very structure of international capitalism was intimately implicated in the maintenance of apartheid. For radicals on the political new left, revolution in South Africa became a totemic symbol of the possibilities for world socialist revolution, substituting in many ways for the dashed hopes of 1968 in Europe and to some extent in America too. So I want to stress these intimate historic ties and their importance in raising public consciousness, which helps, for example, to explain why familiar corporate names with long track records in South Africa, like Barclays Bank, and we'll hear about this from Simon Stevens tomorrow, were targeted in particular. So too were supermarkets dealing with familiar South African brands like Outspan oranges and South African wines. In the United States, the real motor for disinvestment occurred on the university campuses in the 1980s. Here, calls for sanctions came to be spearheaded by prominent Democratic politicians like Edward Kennedy, as well as the Congressional Black Caucus and the increasingly influential Trans-Africa Forum led by civil rights activist Randall Robinson. The spread of anti-apartheid activism on United States campuses was on a larger scale than anything seen since the Vietnam War. Up until 1985, the US administration resisted pressure for sanctions on South Africa, and of course sanctions and boycotts are not the same thing. But it was President Botha, president of South Africa, his disastrous Rubicon speech of 1985, which some of you will remember, where he wagged his finger, I do a very good impression, at a global audience of millions, which had been expecting him to announce major reforms, but instead he told them to don't push me too far. It was that which changed the political landscape, particularly in America, decisively. It was when Chase Manhattan Bank refused immediately after the disastrous Rubicon speech to roll over South African debts. It was this that prompted a major crisis of sovereign debt for South Africa and led many other banks to withdraw their investments. The following year, 1986, the US Congress passed a landmark Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act with substantial bipartisan support, thereby overcoming Ronald Reagan's reluctance to impose sanctions as well as his personal veto. The Anti-Apartheid Act outlawed all new US investment and trade in South Africa. It suspended direct flights, it restricted imports of key commodities, and it also began to demand a timetable for political change and the release of Nelson Mandela, all a major, major shift in US policy on Southern Africa. This 1986 legislation also marked a rare political defeat for Ronald Reagan, and therefore has to be seen as a way in which foreign policy was used to open up the Reaganite grip on domestic politics at that time. How much more time have I got? Five? Right. Let me ask then, how successful were these boycotts? In the economic sphere, I would argue that consumer and trade boycotts had little real effect. There were always ways in which South African producers could circumvent restrictions. The oil boycott imposed by OPEC in 1973 was certainly very costly for South Africa, and the arms embargo brokered by the United Nations was seen as a major threat to South African security. But in both cases, the South African government mitigated these effects through import substitution and indeed built up important local alternatives. In both cases, the South African government was able, in the field of arms, for example, to build up a very powerful state parastatal arms corps, which then became a major exporter of military equipment. In terms of energy, the local oil from coal industrial process technology, which had been borrowed from Nazi Germany or adapted and also from Francoist Spain, became another potent source of pride in South Africa's national self-sufficiency. What was far more important than boycotts was divestment and disinvestment. And this was absolutely critical because South Africa became increasingly dependent, always was very dependent, on foreign capital. But this became a crisis after 1973 when the oil crisis, prompted recession and secular economic decline in South Africa, from which it never really recovered. But the most important effects, I would argue, economic effects, were in fact psychological. Ultimately, foreign firms withdrew from South Africa, not because of direct political pressure, but because of growing political instability within South Africa, in particular after the 1976-77 Soweto uprisings, simply because this made their investments less profitable and also far more costly to sustain from their own position within America in particular. Most importantly, then, sanctions delegitimized the government, the South African government. It gave political leverage to anti-apartheid leaders within the country, and it gave enormous support to South Africans who were fighting apartheid by reminding them that world opinion and solidarity was with them. And if one thinks of the Israeli case, I think this must be a very different story, because there simply isn't that kind of domestic opposition, that well of domestic opposition that South Africa found, particularly from the late 1970s. The sports boycott also had a very significant psychological effect on South Africa, as I've said, but unevenly so. Cultural boycotts had very little impact, with a partial exception of television, but then the South African government didn't allow television until 1975. And indeed, when they did, some of the first shows, like The Cosby Show, became a kind of unintended consequence, allowing many South Africans, white South Africans, to allow blacks into their living rooms in ways in which they didn't fully understand and didn't fully, perhaps, comprehend. Indeed, the cultural boycotts was partly ignored by the ANC, which was calling for them, because the ANC welcomed the anti-apartheid films, the novels, and the music, which was emanating from South Africa and which was taking an anti-apartheid position. The academic boycott failed utterly to stop right-wing intellectual visitors, people like Samuel Huntington, to experts on counterinsurgency. They all came. Indeed, it only really had any influence on left-wing and liberal intellectual activity, with some bizarre consequences. Nor was it particularly welcomed by many intellectual activists within South Africa who were very ambivalent about the academic boycott. As Jonathan Hislop has pointed out, too often the issue for South African academics was that the distaste was the sense in which foreign academics grandstanded and turned South Africa, the apartheid, into a simple moral matter, which was also about their own sense of identity and moral superiority, rather than distracting, therefore, from the complex political problem that apartheid really represented. So in terms of, by way of conclusion, I would say that we need, that what made the South African, one of the things that made the South African story of boycott so interesting were these very complex ties of intimacy, which had everything to do with very long imperial and post-colonial attachments. Boycotts have to be seen as part of transnational history, and indeed they have, but they always occur within the context of domestic national conditions and histories. In Britain, in America, in Scandinavia, the boycott therefore has to be seen through the prism of national politics. The same indeed should be said of South Africa itself, where the internal struggle against apartheid was always far more important than international pressures, significant as these were. A sense of transnational political solidarity was certainly very important for trade unions in South Africa, for civic organizations, and indeed for the student movement. But locally based anti-apartheid activism never wanted to defer to outside opinion and was always highly sensitive to the superior moral positions taken by foreign anti-apartheid grandstanders. So there are many paradoxes and unintended consequences in this complex story of the boycott movement affecting South Africa, particularly in the cultural and the academic spheres, but also in the spheres of trade and manufacturing. I don't have time to expand any more on these paradoxes, but I'm reminded of a story that I read some time ago, and I cannot remember the source, and maybe somebody will help me. It refers to a woman of senior years and very grand woman meeting in a British church hall somewhere in London, probably very close to where we are now, who attending a meeting, probably addressed by people like Fenner Brockway or Trevor Huddleston or some such, turned back to the partner who had brought her, this is about late 1950s, and said, "My God, the last time I was here was in 1900, and then we were demonstrating in favor of the Boers." So things do change. Thank you very much.